Hello and welcome back to the Unseen Incidents podcast. It's me, your host, Patrick Van Straten. And as usual, I'm joined by Pete Dorman. On today's episode, we are talking about Mo Salah burning bridges at Liverpool, but building a bridge to where? Where's he going to go off to? What does this mean for the Egyptian? Is there any way back? We discuss it from every angle. Plus, we open up the burn book. While over on the paid side, we're answering your questions about how to become a more intelligent football watcher, players who've improved the most in the Premier League this season, and we bring you our usual nonsense in anything but football. That's all of today's episodes of Unseen Incidents. So we're back for another double drop, Pete, as discussed before. You can tell we haven't recorded for a while because like that intro was just like absolutely fucking all over the place. Like I was just like, I don't have a handle on where this is going.
I got a name drop in the intro maybe for the first time in 140 something episodes.
I just don't think it's a big sell, Pete.
You know, I agree.
You know, I'm just like, I'm here, football's here. Also, here's my host, you know.
Yeah, no, I think that speaks more to the fact that the intro was chaotic. I almost stopped in the middle of it when you introed me.
You were like, this has gone too far.
No, I was like, you're aware we're not doing just the paid episode.
Sure,
we need to do the full intro.
Yeah. I mean, look.
You've had a tough couple of weeks.
I would say all week. It's like, it's not like I'm distracted. Like I wouldn't have seen my therapy clients on Monday if I didn't feel like I could concentrate. But I would say that I felt a bit different to normal. It's really hard to explain. It wasn't like I couldn't concentrate, and it wasn't like I was loopy or whatever, because I'm only really on like paracetamol and ibuprofen. Like I'm not on any serious painkillers. But
did they give you any of the good stuff at any point?
I had gas and air they did the reduction. So when they did the reduction, fucking hell. Like, because I'd only ever like tried gas and air when Coco was born. Bro.
Is it good?
Oh my God. I mean,
because Jess had a C-section, so I never got the experience. But like, these were never things.
I think, well, look, that's your cross to bear, isn't it? Like, that's your hardship. Yeah. She had her hardship, but you've got yours.
Yeah, of course.
Yeah, well, I was just like, I'm not going to not try the gas and air.
Sure.
But yeah, so this time I was on the gas and air while they were doing a reduction. So essentially, like, for people who don't know, I've broken my fifth metacarpal on my right hand. So the part of your finger that's inside the hand, basically.
How did you break it?
I can only tell you the public version. Are you wanting me to tell you the private version again?
I don't know.
Did I tell you the private version? I must have done.
You told me, you didn't give me any real detail to anything.
Look, it's not bad, just for anyone wondering, you know, that I'm just like, you know. But there is a public version. The public version is I slipped and fell.
Okay, I heard a different version.
Okay, so but, you heard the real version.
Still don't think it's
you heard the real version.
I still don't think it's a real version because I was reading between the lines as to what it was.
What did you think? What do you think it was?
That a moment of frustration and you quote unquote banged it on a wall.
No, I banged it on the sofa.
Banged it on
the sofa. No, it's on the sofa. Yeah.
Okay.
So the sofa is how I did it. But the sofa has like, as I've discovered, it has cushioning on both sides, but on top it has a piece of wood, and it is not a flat piece of wood. It is like the angle of like, you know, a cuboid piece of wood.
Okay, so you hit the corner basically.
So I went bang on the top of it and went into the kitchen, and I was like, fuck, that really, like, I did it, and I was like, shit, that really hurts. And I went to the kitchen and I looked at my hand and I was like, oh, I think that's probably dislocated, you know, because my fifth
It was
knuckle.
Around the knuckle, wasn't it? Yeah.
My fifth knuckle was not where I'm accustomed to it being. It was, I would say, in the middle of the back of my hand. So I could see it, but I was like, that doesn't seem right.
So it had moved in and round?
It had migrated considerably. And then Emma came down and she was like, can I look, like, have you actually hurt it? And looked at my hand and she was like, oh my God, like, you have to go to A&E now. This is on her birthday,
by the way. She told me that her birthday's cursed. This is just
Had like food had just arrived, children down for bed, about to open the presents, like, genuinely horrible timing. So yeah, went off to A&E and I was like, nah, it would just be dislocated. And then they were like, yeah, that is broken.
But it was just
like burn. Literally snapped the shaft of the metacarpal.
Banged unintentionally or in frustration?
Oh no, it was like completely intentional.
Yeah, yeah. That's what I figured. But you just said banged my hand.
Yeah, it was intentional. I was really frustrated. I'd had a really frustrating parenting evening.
Yeah.
And I came downstairs and, like, you know, it wasn't like anyone was like Emma was walking up the stairs or was heading up the stairs when I did this. Like, the children are upstairs in bed. So there was nobody was like fearful, you know.
Yeah.
And I wasn't like angry. No. Well, I guess I was angry, but, like, you know, I wasn't angry at somebody exactly. I was like frustrated and I just went bang, you know, and it was not great. So that's where I've been. So, like, broke my fucking hand. And I was just like, is that good?
Yeah, I was going to say, like, either it depends the way you look at it. It's either like big macho strength or weak little bones.
I've never broken a bone though, Peter. So that's my first bone break. My bones are game day players. But I was just like, is that good to have in a fit of frustration? Like, I was just like, yeah, if I didn't already think about anger quite a bit, this would probably be a point to maybe do some soul searching about anger. Because it's not ideal. So yeah, anyway, that's what's going on. And the gas and air.
Yeah, sorry.
The gas and air is interesting though, because when I was on the gas and air, I was just like kind of lying back. You know, I was like as if on a sun lounger, and my hand was on a little table next to me where my drink would be. No, this is not in A&E. They did jack shit in A&E. This is when I went to Chelsea and Westminster's trauma hand clinic like 2 days later. So my hand has just been broken for 2 days, just wrapped in a bandage, basically.
Okay.
So I go to the trauma hand clinic on the Wednesday, and then I see, you know, junior doctor. So I'm on the gas and air, breathing it in, and they would say stuff to me, or I'd feel her like pulling my finger and massaging the back of my hand, trying to get the bone into position, basically.
Mm-hmm.
And then I would like open my eyes or turn and look at her, because I was just kind of like lying back looking up at the ceiling, really. And then after a while, I closed my eyes because I was just laughing too much, because I just kept laughing. I was like, this is so weird. And like, you could feel the pain. I was like, I could feel all the pain, but in a really remote way. As in, I was just like, I could feel the pain in my hand, but I'm like not really involved in it. It's like,
well, kind of like when you have like, you can feel a splinter in your hand and it's not sore, but it's like a little bit weird.
It's just very distant. It's just very distant. I was just like, that really hurts, but like very distantly, you know, like it was like the pain is traveling from a long distance away. But she would say stuff to me. So she'd be like, keep going, you know, like every few seconds, like obviously the way they're trained too. So the doctor would say, keep going. The junior doctor would tap me on the leg every single time, like just like in rhythm, to make sure I was still like huffing and puffing on my little like hooter, you know, my little crack pipe.
Yeah.
And it's actually more like a kazoo, isn't it? But like basically on my kazoo.
Yeah, does it have like a big circular thing just before the nozzle?
Yeah. And so it's like trying to play, you know, Flight of the Bumblebee or something on like on the kazoo. Yeah, so they would be talking, or I'd feel her massaging my hand, and then I would turn and look and she would just not be doing that. Like, it was like everything was time delayed. It was so weird. So I would literally hear her speak and look at her, and she was just like not saying anything, or she was on the other side of the room getting something. It was fucking weird. And then I went and like had to have the x-ray, and I was just like laughing, waiting for the x-ray. Like afterwards they were like, how was that? And I was just like, I'm being really weird. I started trying to talk to her, and like we kind of joked around a bit, and then I was like, I'm sorry. Like, I think I tried to say thing. I was like, everything. And then I said everything. And I was like, you know what? I'm being weird. I'm going to stop now. And both the doctors are just fucking laughing.
You started pranging on gas and air.
Yeah, man. I was like gacked up on gas and air. So yeah, I just went and like sat in the waiting room for my x-ray, just like laughing away. And so now anyway, I'm in this little thermoplastic splint. I've basically been discharged from the doctors. I've just got to like keep going and seeing hand therapists. Like 5 times a day, I take this motherfucker off and I have to do these exercises. Like kind of gang signs. So I have to do like a little like, you know, kind of duck thing where you like bend, you know, your hand flat from the knuckles. And then there's another one where you kind of do, you know, the way that Americans give the finger, where they don't like the way that you would give the finger is you do a proper fist, right?
Yeah.
And then you just unfold the middle finger. But Americans kind of like half fist.
Take my strong hand it. Yeah.
Yeah. So they're like, so their fingers bend at like the middle knuckle. So I have to do that as well, kind of like monkey paw thing.
Yeah.
And then I have to like kind of spread my fingers as well, forwards and backwards. And that is fucking horrible, bro. It's horrible. And also, when they took this fucking plaster of Paris off after 12 days, I couldn't say this to Emma because I was like, you will never have sex with me again. But but I was like, my hands fucking stank. And I said this to her, like that bit I'd tell her. But what I couldn't tell her is what it smelled of, which is what it smelled of was salami. I mean, like, you know, like artisanal salami. And sure. I was like, I guess it is like dried meat. Yeah. I guess that's like literally what happened.
Cured.
So,
yeah.
So I was like, this is not like a smell where you're just like, it's not like BO, like, which is kind of what I expected, that I just sweated into the bandages, right? But no, it just smelled.
You were slowly
grim.
Curing your forearm.
So I've been trying to exfoliate this fucking hand over the last few days. And I've cut my nails and everything and like tried to get back into a reasonable situation. And now my hand smells like a, like basically like a human hand again. So yeah, anyway, pretty eventful. Don't recommend breaking your hand on purpose.
On your wife's birthday.
Yeah, also don't recommend that. But yeah, so a bit silly really. But the NHS, very good. But the reason we had a cover story was just because, like, literally Emma was just like, I cannot be asked with somebody asking me, do you feel safe around him? You know,
fucking hell, yeah.
She was just like, somebody will be like, oh, so he hit an object, you know, like, what's next? You know, and oh. She was just like, I can't be fucked with that. Like, just tell him you slipped and fell.
Yeah.
And I was like, yeah, sure, okay.
I mean, I think there's like...
Also, no one's interested. Yeah. Like, this is the thing. People say, oh... Like, it's fucking weird, man. It's like being a weird celebrity that strangers are just like, how'd you do that then? And I'm just like, you don't care. Like, what do you mean? How'd I do that then? Like, I broke my fucking head. Like, who cares? Like, what possible... As soon as you tell them the story, they're kind of like, oh, okay. You know, and you're just like, you're not fucking interested. Like, it's so annoying. And also, like, everybody... I've got to say, this country is full of people, principally men, who need to be told they are not funny. Because there was a guy the other day when we were picking up our kids from ballet and he was on like crutches and he was like, what is this, mate? The hospital. And then he just wouldn't stop making jokes for like 5 minutes and they were just all not funny at all. And I thought, you know what? Again, I know I've talked about this in the Burn Book before. He didn't say this to me, but I knew he was this kind of guy. That kind of guy who's just like, you got no sense of humor, mate. Or just like, you must be fun at parties or just like, need to lighten up.
They assume you're boring because you don't find them funny.
Exactly. And I'm just like, you do. It's so weird that when you tell a joke that's bad, your assumption is that I'm the problem.
Yeah.
No, you told a joke that's bad, you fucking penis. So like with those people, I'm just kind of like, I give you one mercy smile. And I think and by just smiling at you, but not laughing, I'm making it clear that like, I'm not being a dick, but I also don't want to encourage what's happening.
Or just generally engage further than this.
Yeah. So a load of people very interested in it. Like when children are interested in it and they ask me, I'm like, that's fine. Like the kids at Coco School will ask me about it. And I'm like,
well, they're kids. Yeah.
Yeah. I'm like, your kids. And that's perfectly. They're like, what's wrong with your hand? I'm like, great question. You know how you annoy your dad sometimes? You know, so, so like, yeah, I'm happy to talk to them about it. But everybody else, I'm just like, fuck off. Come on. Like, it's just not interesting. It's just boring. So anyway, broken hand. But shall we talk about what we're here to talk about today? Because
from broken hand to broken relationships.
Broken relationship, broken bridges. So basically, Mo Salah obviously is the major story this week. Like Mo Salah has been benched a few games in a row now. He didn't play in the Leeds game at the weekend. And Arne Slot, to be honest, was kind of like, well, there's a good reason there. Like we had the lead going into the dying minutes. Why the fuck would I bring on Mohamed Salah at that point? But Salah very rarely talks to the press. Mm-hmm. I think actually after this, Jamie Carragher said something like, Salah has stopped and spoken in the mix zone like 4 times in 8 years or something. But he did it last season. Obviously, he went and spoke to the press when he was like, I'm more out than in.
Yeah, the contract saga.
Yeah, and he got what he wanted. And this time he went out and did it again. So he was like, I've been thrown under the bus. Someone doesn't want me in the club. Relationship with the manager's broken down. You know, basically kind of like, let it be known that maybe he's going to leave. Even he's certainly open to leaving.
Like at the end of it, he says like he phoned his mum to tell him to come to his parents to come to the Brighton game because it's he doesn't know what's going to happen after AFCON. It could be his last time at Anfield, even if he plays or not. Like it was really deliberate in the way he phrased it all.
I mean, he is. Yeah, exactly. I mean, It wasn't planned in the sense of, like, he didn't get, like, a pet journalist. You know, like, sometimes there's that journalist, you know, like somebody in Spain would get, like, some absolute fucking snivelling bitch, like Guillaume Balaguer, to come and sit down with him. Yeah, because he's fucking nobody. Like, who would come and sit down with him and just, like, you know, take his tongue out of his arsehole for, like, for 1 minute just to lick his pen nib. And then put his tongue straight back in, like, just so he can get your quotes on it. But it did seem that he had at least planned some of what he wanted to say. And he was, like, really clear. He was basically just like, fuck this, I want out.
Yeah.
And the interesting thing about it is you're like, it's not, there's no way that what he said gets him back in the team, you know? Like,
no.
As in,
but
like, as in, if I,
when has that ever happened though? Like, when
is it? Yeah, but unless his perception, like, you could imagine a scenario where he'd be like, Arne Slot feels like he's right on the edge of losing his job.
Sure.
And if I do this, that if like say he was, if Mo Salah was 27 and Arne Slot was in the position he's in now.
Yeah.
Then you can imagine that Liverpool would be like, fuck, like,
who do
we actually, do need to choose Salah, but we also can't be strong armed by a player. Like, what do we do here? So that would be kind of an interesting one. But in this situation, you're like, there's no scenario where this gets Salah back in the team.
No.
There's no scenario, like, Liverpool of all clubs will not be pushed into sacking a coach.
No.
Like, Liverpool do exactly what they're going to do. So I was like, he can't actually achieve getting back in the team. I guess we could talk about what he wants to achieve later. Like, I know you wanted to talk about, like, whether he has a point here, because, like, that is a part of the debate, right? I mean, his use of the phrase, like, thrown under the bus is a bit of a weird one.
Mm.
Because, like, I guess that if the team's playing badly and you get benched, then you can make the argument that, like, they're saying I'm the problem.
Yeah.
I think that's a bit of a stretch. Yeah. You know? Like, I think everyone's just like, bro, you're just not playing very well.
Did he also see in the video the press officer standing behind him?
Jesus.
He was wearing, like, if you look at go back to the video and watch it, there's a guy in a yellow lanyard standing directly behind Salah, who is the Liverpool press officer, and you can literally see the soul leave his body the moment, like, he drops, like, the first or second bombshell. He winces when he says the club's throwing me under the bus, and then he doubles down and says, like, something like, there's clearly that, basically, clearly Slot doesn't want me at the club, and then you can just see him, like, start typing furiously, being like, we've got an issue. But you can literally see the moment the soul leaves the press officer's body, which is quite funny. But
then if you're the press officer, you're like, your options are either, like, walk away or you cause a huge stink and you end the interview. Like pull the fire alarm. Like, fucking, who cares?
But you can't do that, really, because he's like in a scrum around, like, it makes it even more.
I know, but then, like, why are you there? Like, what's the point of you? If you're, like, the point at which he's saying, like, this kind of stuff, like, you might as well walk off, because you're not in a position to stop anything, and you no longer care about protecting the player, you know?
Yeah,
you should have like a syringe of just like horse tranquilizer, but just just on tap, so that when somebody says some insane shit like this, you can just be like,
whisk him away.
Yeah, you can be like, oh, whoops-a-daisy, we've, you know, just shove it in his ass and he just falls over.
But yeah, I mean, it's look, I get why Salah might be frustrated, but it's hard to defend what he said, and it's hard to, like, really justify saying, like, Salah has been thrown under the bus and that Slot doesn't want him at the club and all of these things that he's come out and said, because it just feels like it's a culmination of a frustrating season and Liverpool clearly going through a transitional period where they're moving away from life with Salah, as they should be, as he's 33 years old. They've spent,
well, you say that, but they weren't intending to do that, right? They gave him, like, one of the biggest contracts, obviously, but, like, one of the biggest contracts in Premier League history. Like, I don't think they had any intention of, like, moving on from Salah.
Within the next 2 years, they would have.
In 2 years, sure. But, like, but they wouldn't have paid him this money if they were, like, they expected Salah to be, like, first name on the team sheet season.
But the thing is that the long-term plan always existed without Salah. Yes, okay, they give him a big bumper contract last season. He had one of the, if not the greatest Premier League season as a forward ever. So there's...
Not
Henry?
I would say Henry. I would definitely say Suarez.
Oh, yeah, Suarez. I
think it's Suarez.
We've spoken to this before. Either way, his season last season, especially when you take into account his age, is in the conversation for one of the best seasons ever in a Premier League history from an attacking player.
Sure. It's also, interestingly, a season where, like, the manager, who apparently now doesn't want him at the club, could not possibly have tailored the team,
manufactured the team
to give Salah his dream role.
Yeah.
Like, it's literally like he said to Mo Salah, we are going to give you a position where you get a million goals and assists and you have to do genuinely no work whatsoever.
Yeah, but with that, you can kind of see how that they've shifted from last season to this season, and then moving forward into like the next season, season after that, Salah does feel like he's becoming less of the crown jewel and more of like just another right-sided forward. Because last season, everything was tailored towards him. Trent was there facilitating everything he did. Now, they've lost players like Diaz, Nunez, Trent is gone. They've spent a load of money bringing in new players like Wirtz, Isak, Akitike, completely, not necessarily destabilizing the forward line, but completely changing it and completely changing the roles, the way they play. It's less about Salah now. It still is quite a bit about Salah, they might have shifted now because his output has significantly dropped, at least his attacking output. So
yeah,
that plus a frustrating on-pitch performance from Salah from his best ever season at Liverpool numbers-wise to this, within the case of, what, like 3-4 months? He obviously got a new contract, but like within 22 league games, everything has kind of changed. The dynamic has changed. The feeling has changed. And he's being criticised in the press by everybody. Liverpool generally are being criticised for being pretty weak in defence, pretty inconsistent in attack. And it just feels like, I guess from his perspective, him being dropped for multiple games, 3 games in a row, which I think is the first time he's ever happened at Liverpool, he feels like he's then becoming like the spearhead of this critique movement, which to me feels like a stretch. And it feels like a frustrating, aging player who was formerly unbelievable, struggling to come to terms with the fact that he is getting older, his ability to influence games at the true top level is becoming more difficult. The fact that the team are starting to look past him by signing players like Isak, Ekitike, Wirtz for lots of money means that they are, at this stage, the least Salah-centric that they've, even if they still are Salah-centric, the least Salah-centric they've been since he basically started blowing up at Liverpool. All of this is kind of ushering in an era without Salah. That could be in 2 seasons' time. It doesn't need to be right now. But they clearly have an eye, and they should be. Like, they should. Liverpool, a club as competitive and as good as Liverpool have been over the past decade, Klopp era plus this, they should be getting out in front of this post-Salah world as much as they can.
Mm-hmm. I definitely agree with that.
The issue here is that Salah seemingly doesn't like that, or is struggling to come to terms with that, compounded with the fact that he's also performing poorly. Because the decline is undeniable. Like, the output is undeniably down, and when you spend that amount of money on a player, when the sole reason for him to be in the squad and sole reason for him to get a new bumper contract, which we have said before, was a risk that they might eat shit the second year of that contract.
Yeah.
This is kind of the decline that everybody's been waiting for and nobody's seen. Is it as bad as it seems? Maybe, perhaps not, but it is definitely in decline. And he is a player that's worth a huge amount of money and has a team built for him, or has previously had a team built for him. If he's not firing, then he's not doing anything. And that justifiably merits being benched or being moved in the rotation option, because they need to figure out, one, what life looks like after him, but two, they need to win games. And if they're tailoring their game, or a huge part of their game, to Salah scoring and assisting tons of goals, and he's not doing that, something needs to change. And it feels like Salah coming out and saying this, throwing a toy out of the pram, it just feels like an ego thing to me. It just feels like a guy who is aging and has lost a little bit of physicality, is continuing to lose physicality week on week just by how biology works, and is just struggling to come to terms with once being an incredible, incredible player, and is now a slightly worse player, but also has less facilitators around him, at least less elite facilitators like Trent. It all kind of marries into this perfect storm, plus the whole Liverpool as a team not playing that well, being in a bit of a weird position, being defensively very frail, conceding loads of goals. Like the five games they played up until this point, the last 5 games, I think they've conceded 14 goals. So poor defensive record, poor defending in transition, tons of money spent on forwards, not a lot of great output. Also,
yeah, the attack isn't working either.
If you said,
oh right, Liverpool, if at the beginning of the season you'd said by this point of the season, like, Liverpool's defence would look bad, but the attack was fine, I'd have been like, yeah, that's not that shocking. But actually, the attack doesn't look fine either.
Yeah,
like,
and
it's obviously better than the defence, but it's still not really clicking.
But within that, when you have a 400,000 pound a week forward who you're keeping in the squad because they were unbelievably elite or unbelievably efficient at least last season, if that stops happening, He's 33. He doesn't do a lot else. Like, he doesn't. He's basically afforded the right to not defend, which then also he doesn't progress the ball anymore. He stays high, or he stays higher to get on the ball higher up the pitch in more dangerous areas. And like, when he's not doing that, it's just really difficult to at least say you can never be dropped. Like, nobody can be undroppable in an elite team. Truly, unless you're like a 25, 26-year-old Lionel Messi, or like truly world-class player. And by world-class, I mean like one of the best three players in the world, and you're like 23, 24, 25. I find it difficult to say that a big club can have a player that's truly undroppable, regardless of form, regardless of output, because his decline has been undeniable. Like, if you look at him last season versus this season, his shots per 90 down 24%, on target down almost 50%. His expected goals have more than halved. His expected shot goals per shot is the lowest in his Liverpool career. He's down 30% of touches in the boxes. So basically, he's getting in the box less, he's shooting less, and when he does shoot, the chances are worse.
Yeah.
All of these trends merit, at least temporarily, some time in the bench, just to try something new as a team. Try something else. This isn't working. You said yourself, the attack is disjointed. While it's better in defence, it is still not great. Try something else. Like, you are not outputting the same way that the team would have expected you or hoped that you would be able to continue. So it's completely normal for you to take a little bit of time out of the squad for them to try and figure out something that works. Because there's a load of new faces and a load of really talented players in that like attacking stable. There are 4, 5, 6 variations of forward lines they can play in terms of like a front four, 10 through wingers and a 9. They've also, you know, they played Ekitike and Wirtz together last night or two nights ago, whenever they played Inter. There are loads of things that Slot can do. And if Salah isn't producing the output that you expect him to, especially when the team is geared to get him chances, he's totally merited to get dropped. And
no, I agree.
It's so difficult to, while he has been incredibly the most important figure, probably at least playing figure, in the modern success era of Liverpool, you probably maybe argue Van Dijk, but it's Salah. It's close, but it's Salah. While he is owed like loyalty, I guess, to that, this isn't like disloyal. This is just football. This is just how it kind of works. He also hasn't been like banished from the team. It's not like he's been frozen out saying you will never play for Liverpool again until he made these comments. It's like, you know what? Things aren't working. You're not playing that great. We're going to try some new things. We're going to rotate you out of squad for a bit. See if we can just approach this with a little bit of fresh eyes, a little bit of a fresh approach. Maybe you come back after a couple of games and you feel fresher or things are a little bit different. We're just trying to shake things up, trying to get something new, different out of this forward line, because at the minute, it's not working. And we can't be expected just to continue flogging a kind of dying horse and expect it to just come good eventually. They can't keep dropping points. They need to try something new. And I don't think it's personal, but he's taking it. He seems to have taken it incredibly, incredibly personal.
Well, and even if he did come good, like even if you were like, okay, well, he will play his way back into form, or like we will tweak things so that he's playing well again. It's just like, why? Like, why? Yeah. Like, I do think the best version of Liverpool this season would still have Salah like there, whether starting or just in the squad, right?
Yeah,
like, if Liverpool had Salah for the rest of the season, they'd be better than if they don't have Salah for the rest of the season. But
yes,
will they be worth, is it worth keeping him around? Like, probably not. It's interesting because, like, yes, I agree. Like, ego is clearly like this thing. He said stuff like, he was like, no one knows what this feels like or something like that.
Mm.
He said some shit like that. And it was like, to be benched. Like, every single player on earth knows what this feels like. He was literally talking like he was just like, I can't believe that this is happening. Like, no one has ever taken like shit from a club like this. Like, and I actually think that kind of helped, because like then a bunch of the other players have kind of been way more on the like the club side, the manager side. I think because Mo Salah was so clearly like self-centered. But even if he just spoke off the cuff, no preparation, like out of pure like pained ego, I do think that what he's accomplished with it, he kind of couldn't have planned better, because
do you think?
this means that when he leaves Liverpool, he gets to do it like and maintain his ego, right? Because the narrative will not be he was no longer good enough for Liverpool. The narrative will be he got benched for a couple of games and he came out and said some insane shit, and so Liverpool had to get rid of him, which is like, like Cristiano Ronaldo did the same thing.
Mm.
Like, so, and I feel like it's a little bit like, I can make my position here untenable. So it's not like you broke up with me exactly. It's like, I think it saves a little bit of face. I also think, just from the point of view of like his next contract, like if he had this whole season and ended the year with like 12 league goals, and then like went to Saudi, he probably wouldn't get the offer that he get if he goes to Saudi in January, where he's still a reigning champion and he's like 6 months removed from being like basically the best player in the world. Like, yeah, like it's not the bad time to leave Liverpool, like in January, just like go to AFCON and never come back. Like that, I don't think that that works badly for him. And from Liverpool's point of view, I kind of think it's fine. Like the worry for them is that their numbers at the moment, their output is like cusp of the Champions League spaces. Like it's not like they're the clear third best team in the league or something. Mm. Like their numbers are worse than Arsenal, City and Chelsea.
Yeah.
And they're only in the pack with the rest of the teams. So that is the worry, that if this happens, then like that might hurt them. But on the other hand, like they have so many problems right now that if I were the coach, I'd be like you say, like when you say, you know, you kind of players that are undroppable, I'm just like, if I'm trying to figure out how to make this team work, I want to be able to do whatever it takes to get it working, right?
Yeah.
And what I don't want is to be like, well, do whatever it takes to get it working, but you've only got two centre backs, so those guys pick themselves, yeah. And you have to accommodate this other player who's playing like shit. Like that kind of stuff is very, very difficult.
And also, he does one
thing
that he's not doing very well at the minute.
Well, and who means that you can't really play a formation which gets Ekitike and Isak on the team.
And also means that you have to make loads of concessions elsewhere to make up for what he's not doing in order to be in the pitch.
I would say that Liverpool have had like two impressive players in attack this season. Semi-impressive. Like, I think Hakpo has been really impressive. And I think Ekitike has looked very promising. Even if the underlying numbers are not good at all. Like, he's not got many shots. His XG isn't great. But he does look good.
He's got a decent amount of goals for...
I know, but like I'm saying, like, look, the underlying...
But what
I'm saying is, like, the eye test with Ekitike is very strong, even though the underlying stats are not. But you can't get those guys in the team, and Isak in the team, and Wirtz in the team, and Salah in the team. So getting rid of Salah just simplifies that problem. Mm. Plus, I do think that the pressing is such an issue. Like, they just... they have been a team that has been, like it's been their identity for such a long time, the way they press.
Yeah.
And they just can't really do it anymore. And I don't know if you could ever do it with, like, Salah and Isak at the same time. And so now I think, okay, well, now you only have to carry Isak. That's easier. Someone like Frimpong, you know, you and I, and I think everybody else, well, not everybody else, some people are like, no, this is going to be amazing. Like, Frimpong and Kerkez as the fullbacks. Like, you and I were like, we don't really like these guys as the fullbacks.
I like them as wingbacks.
Yeah. But
in a back five.
I think that's fine. I still think that that's the best option. But Frimpong playing on the right wing in front of a right back, suddenly Frimpong is like above average defensively.
Yeah.
Like, he's a below average defensive fullback, but he's an above average defensive winger.
Yeah.
So you could put Frimpong out there,
he's
and suddenly
like
I'm like
Amad Diallo scenario.
Yeah, and you're just like, okay, here what we've got is like we're starting to get something that makes a bit more sense. And from Liverpool's point of view, this would save, if he goes mid-season, it will save them like, I think like 70 mil or something. It will give them a huge amount of salary space. I feel like, isn't his deal over the next couple of years worth like, maybe it's not 50 mil a season. Maybe they'll save like 40 mil or something. But they owed him a fuck ton of money.
Mm.
And this will just save them a load of money. Yeah, I guess they must have owed him... If it's 400k a week, I guess they must have owed him something like 48 mil over the life of the deal.
According to Capology, he has 41.5 million left on his deal.
Okay, so they'll save like three quarters of the, you know, 50 odd mil that they
were going to pay. But
also
potentially become a much, much more functional side.
Well, but also, I mean, look, we don't want to get into this, but like new financial regulations coming into the Premier League. If you clear 400k off the books, that could pay like Yankuba Minte to be your new right winger,
mm-hmm.
and a couple of defenders. You could pay like three guys 130k a week for the price of one Salah.
Yeah.
Like, that's very good. You can get a DM.
That's
a
salary Sabaz lies on. Sabaz lies on 120.
Yeah, you can get a DM, a centre-back, and somebody like Yankuba Minte. Pretty good.
Of, like that good quality as well.
That'd be amazing. Like, that would be really, really good. And so, from that point of view, I think it simplifies a lot of stuff. I mean, I am kind of, like, gratified that, like, five games into the season, I said, Salah's numbers fucking stink. He's playing like shit. And this is where we are now. Like, okay, is he the only guy playing badly? No. Is the team functioning well? No. But I just think, like, at this point, yeah, you've just got to go for the you've got to choose the future. And like all the minutes that you invest in Szoboszlai and Gravenberg and Ekitike and Isak and Wirtz playing together.
Yeah.
Like, that's the thing. It's not just those guys playing. It's them all playing together. Like, you build these relationships. Like, Mo Salah, the next great Liverpool team, they thought the next great Liverpool team might just be this season, right? Like, they were hoping that this would all just kind of come together and that Liverpool would just continue to be great. And, like, you know, before the season, a lot of people predicted Liverpool to win the league. I didn't. But, though I did predict them to be second, so, you know, I can't crow that much.
Yeah.
But,
Everybody thought the attack would be a little bit more functional than this.
I think whether Salah stays or not, like, the attack will get better. Like,
for sure.
You know, it'll just figure it out a bit. But, like...
We are in December, though.
Sure. I'm not saying it's ideal. But, like, it's not possible for players this talented to play together all season and not working out.
My point is more that I think even the people who were saying, like, they'll finish first or second, assumed worst-case scenario, it would take a couple of months for them to figure it out attacking-wise, not, like, four.
Well, I just think they thought that, like, if it takes a while for, like, the other guys to bed in... Salah will be scoring at the speed of light immediately. And also, I think people are like, they've just signed like the best available striker in the world.
One of the hottest young prospects in the world.
So they're going to have Mo Salah and Isak. And Isak is peak age and he should be ready to go.
Proven as well.
So I think they just thought that would be fine. But like a load of people thought that the next great Liverpool team would just happen immediately. In reality, you now look at it and you're like, the next great Liverpool team, it could be next season. But regardless, the next great Liverpool team does not have Mo Salah as a nailed-on starter.
No.
So, nor should it. So given that knowledge, what are we waiting for? And I think Liverpool would be delighted if they could get rid of him to Saudi. The only problem would be if Saudi didn't want him or if Saudi tried to make a deal that he didn't like, because then Liverpool, I think, would just be stuck with his contract. However, Saudi will just take him. So I think they're kind of okay there. Now, I don't think he's been scapegoated at all. Just to close this off, because, like, you know, there's a limit to how much we could talk about this, really. And, like, just to close this off, like, my opinion, I'm like, Salah has not been scapegoated at all. In fact, I felt he was getting a lot of latitude for really, really fucking bad performances for a lot of the season. I think that this is just, like, everybody will get what they want out of this. Salah will go somewhere else where he's the king. He'll get paid an insane amount of money.
Mm-hmm.
Liverpool will get out from under a contract which they thought was a risk, because they obviously, you know, debated giving it to him until eventually they felt like his performances were so good that they were obliged to do it. And Liverpool can get a bit more wiggle room to start thinking about what's next. So, yeah, I don't know. I think that this is kind of okay for everybody, but I do think that professional athletes are maniacs. I don't blame them in a way.
But also, I don't think you get to that level of performance without being somewhat of a... unhinged person.
Well, I think that you can't.
It's the same way when you meet ex-pros.
I don't think the idea that you have to have the most insane level of belief, like blah blah blah. It really annoys me, that shit. You know, when people are like, "Oh, well, the thing that makes Cristiano Ronaldo like so amazing is that he's such a fucking massive cunt," and I'm always just like, I don't really think that's true.
I think it's just this unmanageable level of competition that never leaves him, and then they get frustrated once they're not able to compete at the same level.
Yeah, I do think that Mo Salah basically is just like, I've been one of the best players in the world forever, and now I'm on the bench, and I literally... Like, what's funny about it is, you know, he can't... The only thing that makes sense to him is that it's malicious.
Yeah, I can't be declining.
He literally cannot compute the idea that, like, it's just like a decision made... for the good of the team.
Yeah.
You know?
Or even just based on performances. Yeah.
Yeah. Like he actually can't like compute that like bit of information. And instead he has to say, no, somebody is out to get me. Like that's the only way this makes sense.
Yeah.
Which is extremely funny. So yeah, I don't know. I think everybody should, people say it's a sad end. You know, people are saying, oh, it's a bit of a sad end. But I also kind of think like this was the only way it could end. It was either not going to end or it ended badly. There was just no way it was going to end well. So this has accomplished like what it needed to do.
So based on the way you phrased that, I'm assuming you're not considering any pathway back.
I just don't.
Because I probably don't see it either.
All things are possible.
Yeah.
And I do think Mo Salah, you know, like would obviously rather be a key player at a top, you know, a top European club than earning a king's ransom in Saudi Arabia. Like, he clearly would prefer that. However,
as long as he's involved, yeah, and performing.
However, I just find it really, really hard to, like, I just find it really hard to see it happening.
I don't know how he comes back.
Well, also because Slot's not going to say, yes, come back and you're going to play every game.
Yeah.
Right? If you try and imagine how the conversation would go, and Arne Slot was like, it's nothing against you, man. I'm trying to get the team working. Come on, we've got to figure things out, you know, blah, blah, blah. And like, did all this kind of stuff. And then Mo Salah would say, okay, so am I going to start the next game? And Arne Slot would be like, well, I don't know, maybe. Like, then Mo Salah is like, well, fuck you. Like, I'm out of here. Like, you can't give him the thing he wants, which is to be 28-year-old Mo Salah again.
Yeah.
You can't bend the knee to him
as a manager. And yeah, I mean, there's potentially a way back, but it'll be like, he kind of has to grovel, not grovel, but like, he'll certainly need to apologize. And it will be made kind of clear that what he said was like, oh, it was just a heat of the moment, I was frustrated kind of thing, and accept a lot of the blame or all of the blame in that scenario, which I don't believe he's going to do. And then outside of that, it's like, I guess AFCON's happening at a good time because it gives them both a bit of distance. And they can figure out what's next. It gives the club a bit of time to kind of look at the market, test some Saudi waters. Apparently, there's some links to the MLS as well.
Okay, that makes sense.
I'm pretty sure the new expansion franchise, San Diego, is it? Is it San Diego?
I don't fucking know.
One of them is a backed by an Egyptian billionaire. So there's like a nice little narrative there, perhaps.
Okay.
At least it gives them the chance to like kind of secretly test the market a bit. Maybe he moves in Jan, maybe they just facilitate a move in summer. But I would be very, very shocked if he sees the second year of his contract.
I think a dumber club would potentially like put pressure on the manager. You know, a club where, like, I don't know, if you had someone like Daniel Levy getting involved, like, I can imagine him doing something idiotic. Or if you had just like a weak club full of like craven, like idiotic middlemen like Manchester United, then like you could totally imagine them being like, we can't lose Mo Salah. Like,
we didn't do that with Ronaldo.
Sure. Like, but my point is that like Liverpool
we're elite at banishing players. We banished half our squad in the past.
Yeah, but you banish nobody. You banish like just like academy graduates usually. Like, of all the clubs though, that are going to say, yes, we will abandon our strategy and our principles and even our manager in order to make this old player happy. Yeah. The one club that will not do, the last club on earth that would do that is Liverpool. So, I think in the end, like, does it end acrimoniously? Yes. But does everybody kind of get what they want? I think also yes.
Yeah.
I think it doesn't feel good for fans, but in reality, like, I think you've probably like accept that you're like, do we want to keep Mo Salah happy or do we want to win? And ultimately, I think it's fairly clear that Mo Salah at this point is like, but I want to be happy.
Yeah.
And Liverpool are like, but we need to win games. I also don't think it's just going to fix everything. So in that sense, like, you know, if he's like, I'm being scapegoated, they're saying, like, basically they think that everything will start work. Like, I don't think anyone at Liverpool thinks everything is going to start working just because, like, you know, there will be some fans who say that. If he goes, they'll be like,
they'll say,
not necessarily that. They'll just be like, oh, I thought that, like, dropping Salah was, like, was the solution. I don't think anybody thinks that.
I don't think it's the solution. The long-term solution.
No, it's not a solution to anything.
At his age, it's like the next iteration of Liverpool exists without Salah, so you're kind of basically expediting that.
But that doesn't mean it's like that you're solving a problem you have by getting rid of Salah. Like, yeah, that's true, but like it doesn't actually solve a problem. Like right now, like getting rid of Salah right now doesn't fix the defense and it doesn't fix the attack. It doesn't do either. And even if the next great Liverpool team doesn't contain him, getting rid of him now doesn't necessarily accelerate your move to being that team. Like, you can build towards that team with an old player and then move that old player on when the time comes. Like, that's totally fine. Like,
but I think difficulty comes when the system's built around that aging player. You if you remove him, you allow the system to evolve without him,
but the system this season is not built around him.
The system this season is towards getting him chances, but yeah, I less so than that, much less so than last year. I agree with that.
Sure. I don't know. I don't think that it solves things. I just think that it like gives them a bit more wiggle room with which to solve things, I guess. But
yeah, I think that's fair.
Mo Salah, I guess, out of the Premier League. That not, I can't say as a rival fan that I will be sad to see him go. get him out. He just scores relentlessly. Fuck that guy. All right, should we move on to the burn book? All right, burn book time. I'm going to start with what I'm taking out of the burn book.
Okay.
I'm taking the NHS out of the burn book, bro.
Why, Patrick?
The NHS fucking rocks. It's so good, man. Like, think about it. I went to A&E. I had some fucking x-rays. Nothing else, but I had some x-rays.
Well, you got a bit of bandage for a broken bone.
Sure, and got a bit of bandage.
And a 48-hour wait.
I then went and saw two doctors 2 days later. I was in and out in 2 hours. Again, another round of x-rays. So it's three x-rays each time in different positions. So three x-rays the first day, three x-rays the next time, and, you know, they splinted it and all that shit, gas and air. That was on a Wednesday. Then the following Monday, saw another doctor, three x-rays again. Then a week after that, saw another doctor, three x-rays again, new thermoplastic splint. Saw the head of the department and saw the hand therapy team too. Like, I've now got another appointment with them. Every single time I've been in and out in 2 hours. I've had
four
trips.
And this is all in like 3 weeks as well, right?
Four trips to the hospital in 2 weeks.
2 weeks?
It's been 2 weeks, 2 days. Four trips to the hospital in 2 weeks. Every single one has been in and out in 2 hours. Every single one, like, straightforward, easy, x-rayed, checked. You know, I've had so many x-rays. It's actually quite concerning. But like, I've had x-rays every single time. I don't think I'll have x-rays this Friday, but they'll give me a new thermoplastic splint. Like, I've had so much attention. Have I paid for it? Have I fuck? Haven't paid a penny for it. And like, I always think, you know, it's kind of sad that I know so much about Americans, that I know that some people have to pay for healthcare. Because like, when I was a kid, it never would have occurred to me that somebody would have to pay a doctor. But now, obviously, you know, we do know that. And
yeah,
I just think it's fucking insane. Like, I've had so much care. I've had so much attention. And I put something about the NHS on Twitter, and a guy replied to me saying, like, I broke my finger and, you know, insurance didn't fully cover it or something. And the bills are like 27K. And I was just like, excuse me? Like, that's like a life-changing amount of money.
That's a used Porsche.
It's a wage.
Like a, yeah.
Like, it's so much. I love that your analogy is like, that's Porsche. A Porsche. I thought you'd be like, that's a Patek Philippe. Like,
no, Courtney, that's not a Patek Philippe.
It's an IWC.
Probably a JLC as well, probably.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. But it is astonishing, really, you know, that no one has hurried me out. It's not like they've ever tried to be like, okay, let's keep this to the minimum number of appointments. They just give you an appointment. Like, sometimes they're like, I don't know, well, we'll do another appointment just to be safe. We'll do another round of x-rays just to check. Like, all this kind of stuff. And it is just fucking amazing. Like, to have gone in and out, like, every time in a couple of hours. Like, admittedly, I haven't used the NHS, like, a huge amount in my life. Like, I go to my GP and stuff, but I don't. You know, I feel a bit bad that this is my own fucking doing, this stupid break. But at the same time, like, I reassure myself that, like, I've never broken a bone before. I don't really ask very much with the NHS. Mm-hmm. But it is kind of astonishing to just be looked after and cared for and to have everyone be fucking nice to me and, like, get the job done. And, yeah, I just think the NHS is amazing. And it's basically the only good thing about this country, except for Arsenal. And and I just think, like, there are people in the UK who hate the NHS and think it shouldn't exist. And I just think, how fucking stupid do you have to be? Like, what a fucking stupid piece of shit you must have to be to fucking think that. You must just be the scum of the earth. So fuck everyone who wants to privatise the NHS. We should shoot them all into the fucking channel. And yeah, I love the NHS. It's the fucking best thing. Best thing on earth. And I just have like a perfectly nice time every time. Like, so the worst part of going to the doctor, the worst part for me has been like, it's a bitch to get to Chelsea and Westminster Hospital. That's the worst part of it. Really,
the commute. I think the
commute to the hospital that I've done incessantly.
Yeah, I think there are obvious frustrations that can exist with the NHS, but largely due to it being on its knees, it's underfunded, all of that stuff. When we had Bonnie, I don't think we had like the most amazing experience with the NHS.
Sure,
but it wasn't like awful. Some of it wasn't great, but like none of it was like bad. We were never like, holy shit, this is like,
sure.
Quite bad. I guess the worst.
Some of the community midwife stuff, I do think, is pretty like ropey.
But also, I think on the day we were having Bonnie, or the day before we had Bonnie. So Bonnie was born on a Monday. That meant on the Sunday we needed to go into the hospital for like the final check and like the briefing and all that stuff and some like tests or whatever. But we did that, and then we were sitting in the waiting room and we heard like the nurses having a conversation, and basically they phoned the person being like, by the way, you've not turned up for your like appointment. Same appointment we were getting, meaning this woman's having her baby on Monday. And she was like, oh, I was told I was having my baby on Wednesday. And they were like, no, you're tomorrow. You need to get here like in the next 40 minutes. And I was like, that's not great. If somebody thinks they're having a C-section on Wednesday and it's actually 2 days before and they've not been told.
Yeah, that's crazy.
And then there were like other things that happened that basically like the system that they had was this just like literal written book, but then they had to input the information from that book onto the actual digital system, which then got sent to like the surgical department or the people who actually performed the sections, all of that. But that relies on humans putting that in. And basically somebody had written people in for C-sections on the Monday that hadn't been put on the system. So they were meant to do three C-sections a day. We had five on the day that Bonnie was born.
But then I look at stuff like that and I'm like, that is not an NHS problem. Things like that, I'm just like, people fuck up in every medical system. And I do think that there's very little that's wrong with the NHS that couldn't be solved by a massive injection of funds.
Oh, for sure.
You know? Like, don't get me wrong, I don't think it's perfect or anything.
But
I do think that the problems with it can be solved by just like giving a load of fucking money to it. But I think that even in the best system in the world, sometimes someone is going to fuck up on dates. You know, I have my issues with midwives, certainly. Community midwives, I think, are really dodgy stuff. Like, there's loads of shit there where I feel like they really push breastfeeding. They can be judgmental as fuck. Like, I certainly heard crazy shit from midwives when Coco was born. And, like, I know so many women who are like, I did not feel supported when I was learning to breastfeed, for example, fucking horrible.
We had to go to a breastfeeding clinic that was a community clinic run by, like, medical professionals, but it wasn't. It wasn't in the hospital. It was in like a community center.
Yeah.
All of the other things did no help. But yeah, it's basically like, yes.
Emma used to cry after every visit for the midwives because they would just make her feel so shit. And it just got to the point where I was just like, can you just fuck off?
Well, like, we never got visits from the midwife.
Yeah,
we had to go to them from day three. We had to go to them. They came out once. Bonnie was 3 days old. Jess had like major surgery 3 days before. We had the trips across Croydon. I mean, we drove, but like, yeah, again, funding. They don't have the funding to have the amount of people on the ground to go out and do house visits. So yes, a lot of this can be solved by funding. But yeah, like, while those weren't fantastic experiences, they were still fine. And the baby was like, the duty of care in terms of like the surgical removal of the baby, fantastic. Mm. And it's all paid for by the collective taxes from the country. I've just Googled what an average C-section costs in the US, and in Google AI, which could be wildly wrong, but it says like $30,000, which is outrageous.
Yeah, man. Like, I tell this story a lot, but like, my sister was born in Paraguay, and my parents were like, after she was born, we got the bill from a hospital, and it included like down to the number of cotton wool balls that they'd used, like. That's how minute it was. And I was like, that's fucking crazy. Like,
I've seen bills put online where they charge for skin to skin contact. Like, they charge you $50 to take your baby and set it on you for skin to skin contact. Like, that was a billable expense.
I'll do that for 40. Yeah, I mean, like, the idea that you should like be able to make money off people's health. Sick and having babies and stuff is so revolting. But yeah, anyway, the NHS been good to me, and when you need it, sometimes you're just like, fucking hell, like, it is here and it is amazing. And
yeah,
the people in it like are generally fucking trying really hard.
Yeah.
In like pretty often pretty dire circumstances. Mm. It's the same way that like when I was an NHS therapist, and I would just like, I see people now complaining a lot about therapy they've got on the NHS. And I do like understand it. It is fucking annoying. But I'm also kind of like, the therapists aren't the problem. Like, the problem is that it's just like underfunded.
Yeah.
You know, but it's always the people on the front line who take shit about it.
Yeah. I've always said that like the NHS is literally propped up on just the goodwill of the people that work for it, because so many of them are put in scenarios where they're like, I'm not getting paid to do that. I was meant to finish four hours ago. I'm not getting paid for this. But if I go, the knock-on effect that has is like literally life-changing for people. So I just cannot do that from a personal moral point of view.
It's like any company in a way where they're just like, oh, we've created a situation where we basically say to you, but it has to be done.
Yeah.
Like this used to happen at fucking Sky as well, like at DV, right? Where it was just like, oh, uploads need to be done. Like the uploads aren't done. And you were like, well,
you pay me till 5:30.
Exactly. And it was just like, well, people would end up staying till 8:30, 9 to get these to get these fucking uploads done. And sometimes that was their fault. You know, like people would fuck around on Fridays and not get their edits done. But sometimes you were just like, so now we just have to stay here and do like another 3 hours of work. Like through no fault of our own, but we just have to do it because it's like, oh, but that's what we want to do. And there was so much shit that worked like that. And the same, like very close to when I was leaving, I'd already decided I was leaving. But I remember when they were kind of like, they said, oh, we've got a bunch of slots for you guys to appear on Sky Sports News.
Said this,
And I was like, I don't really want to do it, you know, because I was like, I'm leaving now. So what's the point? Give that time to somebody else. But they didn't pay us for that time. They just took us over and did it. And that was true for a bunch of talent from FD. Like, I'm not going to talk names because I don't want to like blow up people's spot, but where other people just went over and they were like, well, now you can work on this show. Am I paid specifically for it? Am I paid more? No.
Did like, you get time off and lieu for it?
You're already paid by Sky, you know, you're already paid by Sky. So like, why would we need to pay you extra for this appearance? So like, because it's an extra responsibility on top of the job that I already do. Like if I say no, you like, like, you can't make me do it.
Yeah, I mean, unless they give you a day off in the week afterwards to accommodate for you working that
even
day.
Even then I could say no, though, right?
Yeah, you like, could, yeah, sure.
You know, but this is the kind of thing.
But then at least you're effectively getting paid for that day.
Sure, but I just think that there's a load of stuff like this where a load of companies, they kind of think, well, we won't pay extra people. We'll just rely on people being unwilling to leave stuff half done.
Yeah.
And as a result, because we do all think that way, and especially I think doctors and nurses think that way, the system doesn't quite fall apart.
Yeah.
Which is just as well, because people have tried to make it fall apart now for, you know, 20-odd years. All right. What are you taking out of the burn book?
So, moving from Big Farm, or Big... It wouldn't be Big Farm. What is the Big Farm version of American hospital or American healthcare system? Like, Big Medicine? Whatever. From one horrible industry to another. Okay. I'm going into the big tech industry here. But what I'm taking out of the burn book is the TV show Silicon Valley.
Oh, it's so good.
Have you seen it?
Yeah.
I only recently found it, and I don't know why it's been a blind spot for so many years, because it's not new. It's like 10 years old. Probably, I think it started in 2014. But I recently found it, maybe a month or so ago, and I've been working my way through it. I'm on season 5 now, and it is just a fantastically funny show. Like, it's a really easy watch, which I'm very keen for. I watch it when Jess goes to bed. Jess goes to bed around 9, 10 o'clock, because Bonnie's still up. She's a little bit unstable at night at the minute.
Okay.
But I'll usually be up for about an hour or two after Jess goes to sleep. And I'll just stick on an episode of Silicon Valley, watch it. And I've had a really good time. It's, if you don't know of it, it's a show basically about Silicon Valley. It is like a young tech genius guy and his mates who are trying to create the next like world-changing app. It's got Tom Middleditch in it, who I've spoken about before in this podcast. He does that Middleditch and Schwartz improv,
yeah, that you love,
like improv comedy show that I don't know if it's on Netflix anymore, but it was. But he does that with Ben Schwartz of John Ralphio fame. If you can find that on one of your streaming services, I would 100% recommend that. Also features Kumail Nanjiani and TJ Miller and Zach Woods, who is Gabe in The Office. Yes, and his character in this is called, he's technically called Donald, but it's actually, they call him Jared. It's just the exact same character as Gabe in The Office. Yes, like to the point of like IP infringement.
He's so good in it.
It's
man.
The same character who is the exact same personality played by the same actor. But I just think it's a really well written show. I came into it by seeing it through like clips online. People had ripped clips of sections of the show, put them on like Instagram or whatever, and the kind of whole narrative around it was that it was like ahead of its time in that the stuff that it was joking about then. Because it's a satire of the whole tech industry. There's like a big company called Hulu, which seems to be an amalgamation of like Google and Apple, and probably a little bit of Facebook as well. And then there's like a Zuckerberg type antagonist. But all of the shit that they were doing, particularly around AI in the like later seasons, is all actually legitimately kind of happening now in the real world. And they were like joking about these scenarios 10 years ago. And yeah, it's just a very
It's really good.
Easy watch. It doesn't take a lot of mental bandwidth, but it's well written. It's funny. There are good characters within it. There are good performances within it. It's rated over 8 on IMDb, which is generally like a good metric of worth. And yeah, like, it's not groundbreaking. I wouldn't put it in like my top 5 sitcoms of all time or top 5 TV shows of all time, but I have thoroughly enjoyed it. And I just didn't, it was weird that it was such a blind spot. I'd never even heard of it until like a month ago, but it is a very well reviewed show, and it's very well done.
I really like it. I really like Big Head,
yeah.
On the topic of like doing no work and getting paid for it.
Yeah, getting put on the roof. Yeah.
Yeah, I think I really recommend it. And I think, you know, sometimes just like an HBO half-hour comedy is like exactly what the doctor orders. You just need like a show that's got like 5 seasons and has half-hour episodes is like the dream find, I always think. I really recommend it.
I also love the Jin Yang character in the later seasons.
Yeah, he's great.
But yeah, if you have access to HBO or HBO's catalogue, legally or otherwise, would definitely recommend checking out Silicon Valley.
Okay. Right, what am I putting in the burn book? Oh, what I'm putting in the burn book is the word performative.
Mm.
And also the idea of it. Because it's fucking everywhere now. And I think partially it's everywhere because a lot of stupid people really like using jargon because it makes them feel clever. It's the same way that, like, you know, the people review films as if they're like reviewing the morality of the people in the film, and they try and like bring political language to it in a way that doesn't quite make sense. It's like, this film endorses Nazism because it's got Nazis in it or something. Like, you see a lot of that shit. But with performative, like, what annoys me about it is that, like, we've lost the proper use of it. You know, like, this is a word that obviously you get it in philosophy and you get it in gender studies, you know, with Judith Butler. Like, these are the key places, like J.L. Austin and Judith Butler. And in philosophy, there's the idea of a performative utterance. So when you say something that also performs an action, the example that's normally given is like, I now pronounce you man and wife. Like, those are just words, but it actually does like change something about the people involved.
Yeah.
And Judith Butler, obviously, she's talking about like gender performance. So basically the idea that like when we talk about gender, we're not really talking about like biological facts about like men and women, for example. We're talking about behaviors that have socially constructed meanings. So like, men don't cry. That is not a biological fact.
No.
Men are not, there's no biological reason for men to be less disposed to crying. But we have decided as a culture that men shouldn't cry. So this is what she means when she's talking about the performance of gender. But like, now people use performative to just mean like fake. Like, that's what people mean.
Mm-hmm.
Like, when they say like the performative male or whatever, they mean like, they don't mean a guy, certainly he's performing his maleness. They basically mean a guy who's like putting on some bullshit to try and get women to want to fuck him.
Mm-hmm.
Like, we already have a word for that. That guy's called a phony or a bullshitter.
Mm.
Like, that's not what performative means. And in fact, performative acts are very important and very useful. So for example, when my daughter tries to talk to me and I put my phone down and look at her, that's performative, what I'm doing. I put my phone down to show her something, to signal something to her, that she has my attention. That doesn't mean it's fake. It has a real effect on both of us, but it is performative. Like, it's something I'm doing in order to make a point, because I could just keep my phone in my hand and stop looking at it, but I put it down to make a point. Like, that is performative. It's not fake. This just really, it really annoys me, because we all do things all the time to demonstrate things socially to people around us. And it doesn't make us liars. So like, if you go to, you know, what the performative male, like the image of the performative male, right, is like you dress up and you take a book to a cafe and like drink a coffee and like, you know, read your book by a woman.
Want to find yourself on the Instagram Hot Boys reading?
Yeah.
There is some kind of Instagram about like hot guys reading books.
Yeah, I know. so like... But sometimes, you know, people may take the angle here of like, well, it doesn't matter if they're, you know, why they're doing it, so long as they're reading. Okay, I think that's one angle. But the other angle is that, like, since there have been human beings have done stuff to make other people want to fuck them. Like, that's completely normal. And somebody going and reading their book in a cafe as a performance is no different from you putting on a nice outfit when you go on a first date or offering to pay the bill when you go on a first date. That is a performative act. It's meant to signal something to the other person.
Mm-hmm.
That doesn't mean it's fake. It doesn't mean it's fake. So this kind of stuff like really pisses me off, because I actually think that the idea of performance is also kind of like freeing in a way. Like, once you understand that your behavior is social communication, you can be honest with yourself about what you want to communicate and why you want to communicate it. But I also think that the upshot of a lot of this stuff, you know, using performativity this way, is that it draws a distinction. You know, it says here are like honest behaviors and here are performative behaviors, i.e. fake behaviors. And the fake behaviors are the behaviors that are geared towards producing a reaction in people. So what does that mean the honest behaviors are? The honest behaviors are the things that you just do or want where you don't care about how they affect other people or what other people think of them. Like, to me then, what we're talking about is the like animal stuff, the stuff that you do instinctively or the stuff you do selfishly, right? Because you're like, well, it's not performative because I'm not doing it to make you like me or to think anything of me, you know? Like, that to me promotes this idea that authenticity is to kind of behave in this instinctive or animal or selfish way. And I just don't see why we would want that at all. I don't see why that argument, why we'd want to make it, but we are making that argument when we say that any behavior that's designed to produce a reaction in other people is performative and is fake and therefore can't be trusted. Like, that's where we end up if we follow that to its logical conclusion. So I think our chosen selves are more who we are than our animal selves, you know? And if you choose to do something to signal something to someone else, I think that you are choosing to be that person and that's really who you are, rather than, oh, it's fake, you know, because it's a performance. Like, so I think that this idea, like, it's a lot of fucking idiots who wave this word around, who don't really understand what they're saying.
I think it's a fundamental misunderstanding, because it's just tying performance to acting, and acting is easily perceived as fake.
Yeah, which, you know, is again an interesting point. Right. But what it really is that it's related to trying to produce an effect in the viewer. Yeah. So I just think that, like, there are a lot of fucking idiots who throw this word around. We are losing the useful definition of the word. But I think that there is this more thoroughgoing problem, which is the implication that to care about what other people think and to act in such a way as to show other people who you are is fake. And it isn't. Like, when I have a female client, I might say something early in an early session, you know, where I say, like, well, that is actually harder for women, you know, whatever, if that's relevant. It's not a lie. I mean it. I think it. But do I technically need to say it? I guess not. So why am I saying it? Well, because it shows something important to them, which is that I am trying to understand what they are telling me from their perspective. I'm trying to, like, empathize rather than just sympathize. That's a really important thing to do in therapy. So it has a material effect, which is it deepens the bond between us. So the performative act isn't bullshit. The performative act is actually, like, part of the foundation of the working relationship. So I just think, like, if you're going to use this word, you should fucking use it correctly. But I also think we should be using it an awful lot less. that's my attitude. And it's just been getting on my tits recently. So that's where I am with that. What about you? What are you putting in the burn book?
What I'm putting in the burn book this week: Christmas markets, specifically winter wonderlands. I've not been to hell, nor do I believe that it necessarily exists. But if I did, I believe it would 100% take the form of a winter wonderland. Everything in them is.
I mean, I went to a school fair recently, so.
Fair. Everything in them, crap. Everything in them, wildly overpriced. They're always about 200% too busy.
You always pay to get in as well, right?
Well, the one we went to, thankfully, we didn't. But yeah, everything about them is just like a money gouge for shit quality stuff and a horrible time because there's too many people. There are literally zero redeeming features to Winter Wonderlands. And there's one in Beckenham Place Park, which is quite close to us, that we accidentally went to. My mum was down and it was a Sunday and we were like, sure, we'll just go out. The park's like 15 minutes away. We drove there, took Bonnie out just to get her out of the house, had a walk around the park. It was kind of like a nice dry winter's day.
Yeah.
And when we got there, we park at Jess's parents because they're like right beside the park and you don't need to find parking at the park, which can get quite busy at times. walked over to the park, and it was pretty normal. And then we got up to like the area where there's like a cafe, a restaurant that sells like pizzas, and there's a little like bar in it that does like pints and stuff. And I was like, oh, it's quite busy, isn't it? And then we saw over yonder the flashing lights and the sound of just fucking horrendous Christmas music pumping out. And I was like, oh, there's a winter wonderland. So we were like, right, sure, we're here, let's go. We walked up. There were bouncers in the door, but it was nothing to be paid.
There were bouncers on the door.
Two security guards checking bags. And we went in. We stood in the middle of it for, I would say, 25 seconds. I turned to Jess and said, this is fucking horrendous. And we turned around and walked straight back out. But it ruined my day. Like, I was I was immediately fuming. Because like, we scanned.
What? Okay.
We scanned around. And I was like, I hate everything about that. I got overstimulated very quickly. There was too much going on. All of it was nonsense. In the middle of it was like, the one thing I can maybe get on board with are the like German hot dog sandwich, hot dog bun things that they do at Christmas markets. Maybe get on board with them, but they're like 16 quid, so no. If they were like half that price, it's a fucking sausage and some carbs. Calm yourself. But I looked around and I was like, there's literally nothing here that is good. There's nothing here that is like worth it, what they're going to charge you. And there are way too many fucking people here. So we turned around and went out. And I was like, okay, we're going to go to where we intended to go, which was the cafe and kind of outdoor seating area with the pub beer, with like the pub bar or whatever that exists, always exists, open all the time in Beckenham Place Park, that we always go to and is always very nice. So we went over there. But the problem with Winter Wonderland being so busy, and they're literally right 200 yards apart, same area, same park, just across like this fake little internal road. But because Winter Wonderland was so busy, everywhere else existed as like an overspill area, which then meant that the cafe concourse area became feral because it was just full of people who wanted to go to Winter Wonderland, too many people, loads of parents just shirking responsibility. Children literally, so they, like, this is like a, think of like a beer garden in a courtyard, basically. Loads of the standard patio tables, you know, the like patio, the picnic benches, loads of them around everywhere, a little undercover canopy. And then at the other side of it is the cafe and bar area where you go and get your food and your beers and stuff. Kids just like hammering through on bikes around a busy courtyard. With like loads of people walking, loads of people carrying food and beers.
That shit really fucking
like
annoys me.
Prams being pushed, little small children like toddling about and stuff, flying through on bikes and shit. And their parents just don't care. There were 50 dogs maybe. And I like dogs, but all of these dogs were like no more than 2 meters away from any other dog at any point. So half of them were going mental at like other dogs, either just in interest or they felt intimidated just with they sort of barking. It was like feral in the actual sense of the word. And I was just looking by being like, this is fucking miserable. The queue at the cafe to get food and drinks, out the door halfway through the courtyard. Biggest I've ever seen it. And I was like, this is just everything about this, caused by Winter Wonderland, by the way. This is a knock-on effect of it, of people just flocking to these shit places. Everything about it was that, like, it's just ruined it for everybody. Too many people, too many dickheads, too many people not taking accountability for their fucking offspring.
Yeah.
And yeah, I was just like, can we just leave? So like mum and Jess got food. Like got like a, I don't know, like some kind of brioche bun, and they had a cup of tea. And I was like, can we just leave and go to like the pub near your parents? And then we ended up actually just going back to Jess's parents because they were in, and we just sat and had a drink at their house and then went home. And I was like, this is so much better. But even just going to the pub for a drink nearby, away from the park, and then going home would have been way better. But yeah, no redeeming features of Winter Wonderland. The one at High Park, the one at Clapham, all of them straight in the bin.
They're all cast.
Way too expensive, way too busy. You get nothing out of it. All full of shit, including the people. And yeah, the world will be a better place without them. They represent the absolute worst parts of what Christmas has become.
Yeah, yeah.
They truly do. A gross commercialization and just hollowing out of any meaning of what Christmas is.
I don't give a fuck about the meaning of Christmas, Pete. Come on.
No. For me, what Christmas means is like getting to see people you don't see that often and they enjoy spending time with.
I don't think about that at all.
One time a year you actually get to meet. Like, we're going home to Northern Ireland next week. I'll get to see a load of the friends I have from home who are scattered all over the world. A lot of them will come back and we'll meet up. And we do that once a year and it's really nice. I'll get to see family members I get to see maybe 3 times a year, one of those times will be at Christmas. That is what I love about Christmas. All the other shit can get fucked. Miss me with that shit.
I don't give a shit about any of that shit. Like, I don't
family and friends.
Yeah, I don't care. Like, I love to get and give presents. That's what I love, and I like the food. That stuff's good.
Miss me with presents. Miss me with presents.
That's the weirdest shit I've ever heard. Look, you're a pervert. Like, Winter Wonderland is objectively like it is fucking awful. Like, we all accept that Christmas is a commercial enterprise, but when people say, oh, Christmas is so commercialized, I'm just like, no. What you mean is it's annoying when something doesn't let you forget that Christmas is a commercial enterprise. You know, like Winter Wonderland, you're being gouged the whole time. And as a result, you can't forget that that's kind of the way Christmas always works a little bit. That's what's irritating about it. It's like being in a casino where you're like, I'm being worked the whole time, or going to a strip club where, you know, people will come up and talk to you, like women will come up and talk to you, and you're just like,
oh, she's really friendly, isn't she?
And you're, yeah, exactly. And you're just like, this is fucking horrible, because like, I do know that you want my money.
Yeah.
And
like, the only reason you're here is to get money out of my pocket.
Yeah. So you can't, you just can't ever forget that you're purely a commodity in there. So anyway, whatever. Like, I don't give a shit about this. I don't think there's a true meaning of Christmas. I think Christmas is a bunch of fucking like nonsense. I think that like baby Jesus.
Little baby Jesus in the manger.
Not important. Not important. Didn't do anything. Fake guy.
Yeah, I think he existed.
I think a Jesus existed.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But you know, like when we say like Jesus existed, I'm like, well,
like a guy, you know, like, at that time.
Like the Jesus of the Bible, did he exist? I'm like, yes, okay. There was a guy called Jesus who I think stories in the Bible are about.
Yeah.
But I also think the stories in the Bible are absolute bullshit. So I'm like, yes, he did exist, but like, did this Jesus exist? Like, yeah, not really.
He exists in the same way Darren Bryan exists.
Sure. Yeah, exactly. But he doesn't exist. You know, it's like saying, does Kim, like did Kim Jong-il exist?
I wanted to know whether you were going to go Kardashian or Jong-il.
No. I'm like, Kim Jong-il did exist, but did the version of him that he tried to say existed exist?
Yeah.
No. Like, that was a story that he made up. Anyway.
The one that played golf once and shot 18, hole in one every hole.
I don't know if he shot an 18.
No, sorry, was that Kim Jong-un?
Maybe he did shoot an 18. I thought he shot like a 20 or something.
Either way, it's okay.
I think they were like, he had a couple of albatrosses.
Like, everything else is a hole in one.
Like, and everything else was a hole in one. Yeah. Like, it's very funny. I always think the state dogma of North Korea is incredible. You know, birds singing in Korea and all that shit. Anyway, that brings us to a close for this week's public episode of Unseen Incidents. Thank you very much for being here. Thank you for all of you who've signed up recently. We really do appreciate you. We will catch a bunch of you over on the paid side, where we'll be answering some of your questions. We'll see you there. Bye.